Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
There may be phenomena that affect the Earth that are greater than that which we can control. I mean, man is very good at controlling his environment. The first species who really does modify his environment rather than being modified by his environment in many cases. So I suppose the lesson of the history of the Earth is to treat the Earth well, because you may be sorry someday. You may become the next extinction.
Historical geology and the theory of evolution, this week on Soundings. My guests are Carl Stock and Nicholas Rupke. Carl Stock is a professor of geology at the University of Alabama. Nicholas Rupke is a geologist and historian of science. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Nicholas Rupke worked on a biography of Richard Owen, the Victorian scientist. I asked Carl Stock and Nicholas Rupke about the teaching of historical geology and the theory of evolution to undergraduates. Here is Carl Stock.
To me, I know that the evolution creation thing is in my mind. I know it's my responsibility to provide the scientific evidence for what most scientists believe, which is evolution. It is my responsibility as a scientist to present the scientific basis for evolution as part of the course. And the course itself, I usually save evolution to near the end of the semester, because I really want to give the evidence and have the students be familiar and perhaps comfortable with the general evidence that's been used to support evolution. I want them to learn that there are fossils, and fossils are changed through time. I want them to know that the Earth has a very long history, really incomprehensibly long for when we think in terms of human lives. Mm-hmm. In terms of recorded history.
Well, where does the rub come in? Nicholas Rupke, let me ask you to comment on this. Is this a commentary on the quality of the scientific education? Is it a commentary on parental sensitivity? We got several strands to tease out here.
Well, as I don't teach geology as such, like Carl does, but the history of it, and mm-hmm. also the history of the evolution debate, I indeed may be able to comment a little bit on this. I think the problem is too great an absolutism on either side of the question. Hmm. I think on the one hand, geologists probably have a completely unassailable position when it comes to geological time, as Carl maybe could explain. When it comes, however, to the interpretation of the history of life through geological time, I think there is a whole range of options. The scientists may have suffered too much, maybe from what one could call Darwinian triumphalism, believing too much in just one particular theory of the origin and evolution of life, based on the chance processes of variation and natural selection.
There's a lot of arrogance inherent in this. There's a lot of sort of condescension. Have I got that right?
That is right. And I think this may have put off a number of people who hold genuine religious or specifically biblical beliefs. I would suggest that that's not quite necessary to be put off by this geological work on the origin and history of life. Hmm. I would have thought that there's a whole range of interpretative options possible.
For example?
I think it would be possible to think about the development of life in a much more guided, theological way. I think it is possible for people to think of the succession of life forms on Earth and the emergence of man on the planet Earth in a way that still would involve divine guidance or some form of religious meaning by looking at man as the goal of creation. I think there is nothing in science that would deny that. There isn't a lot to support it either, may I say. But at least I think there is possible a cohabitation of religious beliefs and first-rate scientific work.
All right, now before a taping session, Carl Stock made a comment that I want to bring up here and have him in turn elaborate upon, and that is that if you buy the premise of geological time, you haven't bought the whole shop necessarily, but mm-hmm. you've made some very fundamental assumptions about science and the doing of science. Do these necessarily, Carl, preclude the question of faith or exclude the question of faith?
I don't believe so. I think that really the faith issue, it is what you can believe. It is whatever you can believe.
What you make of the evidence.
Yes, exactly. And we cannot take animals or plants into the lab and watch them evolve. And so what we as scientists are looking at is the best conclusion we can come to based on the evidence we have seen.
Yeah, for example, you said that a chemist can do an experiment and have it bingo, you know, within 6 hours. A geologist,
right.
By contrast,
in other words,
it
does give us in another interesting luxury, though. It allows us perhaps to use our minds a little bit more, in that we have to think about something and conclude what's the most likely outcome, rather than to sort of, in a way, yield to that which happens before us and which we must accept because we can see it happening.
Well, according to the best geological evidence, let's look at that side of the issue for a moment, Carl Stock. How old is the Earth? You said that the Earth has a very long history.
Right.
But give me some numbers here.
The most popular ages right now that people play with are somewhere between 4.5 and 5.5 billion years. You can't. It's very hard to. I guess one of the best analogies I've ever seen used. Trying to explain, for example, the history of humanity on the Earth compared to the age of the Earth. I saw a movie once where someone was standing next to the Empire State Building in New York. It's a little dated because the Twin Trade Towers are there now, but anyway, it's still a tall building. And they said if you could lay a piece of paper on the ground there, and the thickness of the paper would represent the time of humans on the Earth, or certainly of historical time, perhaps, of humans, and that the height of the Empire State Building would represent the age of the Earth. It shows you, in a way, what it does is, in a way, to some people, I suppose, it trivializes humanity.
Right.
I don't feel that way.
Well, by contrast, Nicholas Rupke, what do the creationists tell us? Does creationism deny what Carl Stock has called this immensity of geological time?
The most vocal groups of creationists who've been in the news in recent years here in the United States certainly do. However, there are other creationist groups, who feel that time isn't a problem, that there is not only a variety of ways of interpreting the paleontological past, but also a variety of ways to do exegesis of Genesis 1.
Mm-hmm.
Right from the beginning of the discovery of geological time around 1800 or in the early part of the 19th century, leading theologians have come up with a number of possibilities of allowing for geological time within a framework of biblical belief.
All right, now how do you, as a historian of science, Nicholas Rupke, how do you present these issues? Do you simply say, put your money down and take your choice, you present alternatives? Do you, as a historian, make a judgment call and say, here's the best evidence on one side or the other of this evolution and creationism debate?
No, that latter option, that latter way of dealing with things is the scientist's way. The scientist weighs the evidence and will say, this, I think, is the best option. This is the truth as far as we can approach it today, or approximate it today. However, the historian, I think, on the whole, tends to be a relativist.
Uh-huh.
The historian likes to show how everything, one opinion or another, right or wrong, actually, right or wrong doesn't very much come into it, that people's opinions and theories are conditioned by factors that...
their own social circumstances. That
go beyond the rationality of the arguments that flow back and forth, uh-huh. by conditions of society, background, politics, what have you, social applicability, what you do is the science, all that sort of thing, their institutions, their personalities.
Carl, how do you teach this stuff? You go in and you have a group of young and tender minds here in front of you as undergraduates, and you say, let's talk about evolution and creationism.
I think probably the real guiding concept that is the thread that unites all of the teaching of Earth history is this a basic philosophy which we call uniformitarianism, which has the key phrase, the present is the key to the past. Mm-hmm. And we basically tell the students that a lot of what we understand about the Earth's history is conditioned or qualified, or whatever, by what we can see happening in the world today. We see mountain ranges today. We see flatlands, and we can basically tell that at one time many mountain ranges were low-lying, flat-lying rocks rather than tall, angularly arranged rocks.
Nicholas Rupke, let me ask you to comment on this. What has happened to the Darwinian premise? Does the scientific community accept Darwin at face value and let it go at that?
Certainly not. They admire Darwin as one of the greatest minds of the 19th century, if not the greatest mind. At the same time, later generations of biologists and paleontologists have added significantly to the Darwinian theory of evolution.
How about subtracted from it?
That too, to some extent. The adding may be interpreted as subtracting. Yeah. For example, in the first place, although Darwin gave a mechanism of selection, he didn't really have much to say about the origin of variation, organic variation. And this has remained a problem. Although the genetic theory of Mendel and de Vries and a number of other what are called neo-Darwinians have thrown much new light on the origin of variations, organic variations, still, if you look through the paleontological past, there seem to be enormous jumps in forms, in organic forms, that aren't quite attributable to small genetic mutations. And exactly what happened during these periods of almost catastrophic change, mm-hmm. Isn't quite clear. We've given a new name to it.
What is that?
The name is punctuated equilibria.
Right.
I think the courage of the punctuated equilibria people of today is that they say, well, after so many years now after Darwin, we still seem to have a very incomplete record. Let's accept the fact that maybe this is an approximation of the real record, mm-hmm. and that we did have major jumps, these major, almost catastrophic organic change periods.
What is it that, apart from creationism and evolution, you know, these sort of headline-y kinds of things, what is it that's going on amongst the geologists today that they find exciting and engaging? Carl, let me ask you to begin.
Well, probably the most exciting thing that's happened to the teaching of geology in this century has been the, I should say discovery and understanding of a phenomenon called plate tectonics.
If you live in California, you've heard of it.
Yes, you certainly will have, and you've probably felt the physical manifestations of that, too. That plate tectonic theory, essentially, as it is, and once again, theory is the correct word because we can't go down in deep into the Earth and actually see the movements that are causing the pieces of the crust of the Earth, the plates, to move about the Earth. But this was a theory which was originally generated through the efforts of paleontologists who noticed the very peculiar distribution of certain kinds of fossils. And
not the geologists, but the paleontologists.
Of course. And it took the work of geophysicists, particularly taking evidence discovered probably by oceanographers, to really show how the mechanism worked, how you could move huge pieces of the Earth this way. For a long time, it was felt that this was just too big a task, that there's no natural mechanism that could possibly, no phenomenon that could explain how we possibly could move huge chunks of the surface of the Earth about. willy-nilly, if you might say.
And yet that is the case today, is it not, Nicholas Rupke?
That is right. And what fascinates me as an historian about the emergence and the success of plate tectonics is that it represents a completely new, or at least different, attitude towards the Earth from what had been shown by geologists for a century previous to the 1960s when plate tectonics came about. The geologists of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th really were hammer and chisel people who went out into the field, collected rocks, collected fossils, and inductively, as it is called, from those basic pieces of evidence, inductively built up theories. They were very much against what they thought were the wild theorists looking at the Earth from the outside. But our perspective now, in part, I think, encouraged by planetary research and space photography looking at the Earth from the outside, our approach now is to look at the Earth as a planet. And that's been legitimized not only by these space photographs and space probes, but also by the success of the physicists, the geophysicists, the oceanographers who've come into geology with their particular evidence. Mm-hmm. And now again, the Earth is looked at, or rather geology is done from what is called the whole Earth perspective. So a deductive perspective up to a certain point.
You could be speaking from the standpoint, without necessarily grinding axes here, no pun intended, you could be speaking from the standpoint of the environmental groups, which is to say looking at the Earth as a complete organism, rather than one aspect of the Earth's history.
As a complete entity. Mm-hmm. I think to call it organism would be going, would be drifting into controversial areas. Uh-huh. Not too far necessarily, but it would be very controversial. Uh-huh. So let me add to this that planetary research, probes to the Moon, to Mars, and to Venus, have made us also very much aware again of the importance of impact phenomena on planets.
So we're not talking now about an aspect of geology or paleontology or biology or the Earth as an entity or organism, but its relationship indeed with, what, the whole solar system?
The entire planetary system, that uh-huh. is right. And the importance, certainly in the early history of all the planets, including the Earth, of the possibility, or rather more of the reality, of the catastrophic impact of extraterrestrial pieces of matter, meteorites, and the new acceptability or the new legitimacy mm-hmm. of thinking about such catastrophic events in the history of the Earth and life has led to the revival of an old theory of the extinction of life, the causes of the extinction of life on Earth, and Carl knows much more about that than I do.
What about this, Carl? Let's talk briefly about this. You mentioned before our taping a series of extinctions.
Yes, it appears that at certain times in the history of the Earth number of extinctions were excessive compared to the average time in the history of the Earth. Some workers have to their satisfaction, documented a periodicity to this, that perhaps every 26 million years or so that we have an unusually large number of extinctions. Others have argued fairly convincingly that this cycle doesn't really work too well, but this is one of the experiences you have to go through when you're working with a new idea. The extinction of the dinosaurs is the one that most people have heard about. It's been in the popular press and in the news even. And people have looked for evidence of extraterrestrial objects. And at the end of the Cretaceous period, when the dinosaurs became extinct, in the rocks that were deposited at that time, there's a very high concentration of a rare element called iridium, much, much higher than you should expect to find in normal sedimentary rocks. One way it is thought to get a concentration of iridium is to have some object from space, perhaps bring some iridium with it, hit the Earth, raise a great deal of material from the Earth up into the atmosphere and have it settle around the Earth.
And yet the distribution...
And this would bring more iridium forth. Uh-huh. So it would distribute it over a large area.
Yeah, but it's an uneven distribution.
Well, got that uneven, right? Uneven in time, number one. Also uneven in geographic extent, yes, because uh-huh. there are certain places where a sediment is more likely to be buried and preserved than other places. And so what happened is that, first of all, after the finding of this iridium associated in the rocks with the extinction of the dinosaurs, this brought forth really the idea that some space object hit the Earth. First it was asteroids, and then comets became more popular. And there's this Oort cloud of comets that the Earth passes through about every 26 million years. Another thing that is very interesting is that people went back and decided to look not just at the very layer where the dinosaur extinction was thought to occur, but to look above and below it just to see what they might find. And lo and behold, in association with the dinosaur extinction, there are now a total of 5 separate iridium layers, at least, that have been found. There is a term that has been derived that sort of brings the compromise between very strict uniformitarianism, which would only allow for cyclical changes, such as changes in the season during the year, things like that. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, that's how uniformitarianism was regarded. A bit of reality or reasonableness, whatever you want to call it, came to it, which allowed for some progressive change. Let me comment on 2 things in relation to this. Number one, if you had a volcano that erupted that was larger than any volcano that we have ever witnessed in the last several hundred years, that's entirely possible. But one doesn't think that the entire country of China would erupt instantaneously or something like that.
Right.
That's a real catastrophe.
We'll leave that to the political revolution.
an unusually large concentration of volcanic eruptions is acceptable. Mm-hmm. Let's just say. But also, I think it should be pointed out that in many of these major extinction events that have taken place, that in the case of the dinosaurs, for example, the dinosaurs were well on the way out for millions of years. And whatever happened at the end of the Cretaceous is what really just was really finished them off. But they were already on the decline.
It wasn't the single cause, that sort of thing.
Right. In other words, it wasn't like there were just millions and millions of dinosaurs, something came from space, hit the Earth, and 3 weeks later they were all dead.
Right.
Much different than that.
Took at least 4.
But even this perhaps 4 or 5 million year period of decline in dinosaurs is just a small part of their entire history on the Earth. The second point that I want to make has to do with how uniformitarianism is applied to evolution. I spoke before about the fact that we do use uniformitarianism as a guiding principle. Essentially, there's an analogy that I use in class that I think works very well, and that is Shakespeare's plays. Shakespeare's plays have been around for nearly 400 years, and obviously the same people are not playing the same roles. The people who played the roles in the beginning are long gone. And what is uniform about evolution is not the animals or plants that happen to be present at a particular time. It is the process of evolution. The rules that govern evolution are uniform. The rules that govern change in life today have always governed the change in life in the past in the Earth.
What you're telling me is that this is analogous to what the literary critics do with the Shakespearean corpus. It's essentially the same, and yet it is certainly not the same. It changes very much with respect to production and interpretation.
Certainly,
through the years.
Different actors, the whole thing, but yet the play is still the play.
What kind of education are American undergraduates getting, geologically speaking? Carl?
Well, essentially, you have to realize that at least most students in the universities and colleges in the United States are getting some science. The core curriculum move has hit most universities, and therefore, most undergraduate students are taking at least 2 courses in science. However, they're choosing from many fields, and geology is very popular on certain campuses. Biology is always very popular. Many of the students who are not scientists are scared away from perhaps what they consider the more technical sciences like chemistry and physics. Mm-hmm. They're more I think they feel they can relate to biology better. Perhaps it wasn't as difficult in high school when they had it, so they think that this is a good way to go. They're concerned with the grade as much as anything, so they're, some of them are there because they want to hear about science, but many of them are there because they have to be there. But anyway, those who do choose to take geology courses as undergraduates, perhaps 20% of the undergraduates will take geology.
Nicholas Rupke, what's your sense of this? Are the geology departments having to sort of sell themselves, as it were, to the undergraduates, you know, to set the tent up and draw them in, get them to take courses?
Yes, I think the irony, coming back to a few points that Carl just has made, is that school kids are taken to the natural history museums to see the dinosaurs or the diamonds or a variety of other things that relate to geology. Yet the subject geology isn't taught in school, so that when they enter university, they often don't know about it. And indeed, the geology departments have a much greater difficulty in attracting students to the interest of the subject, than, let's say, the biological sciences have.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion featuring Carl Stock and Nicholas Rupke. Carl Stock is a geologist at the University of Alabama. Nicholas Rupke is a geologist and historian of science. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Nicholas Rupke worked on a biography of the Victorian scientist Richard Owen. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 463. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about the study and teaching of American literature. My guests will include Fred Hobson of the Southern Review, Everett Emerson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Annette Kolodny, Dean of Humanities at the University of Arizona. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Mid-August marks birthdays for William Caxton, the first English printer, for the American actress Ethel Barrymore, for Sir Walter Scott, the Scottish poet and novelist, for Davy Crockett, the American frontiersman, and for Virginia Dare, the first child born of English parents in the New World. William Caxton was born in mid-August 1422, Ethel Barrymore in 1879, Sir Walter Scott in 1771, Davy Crockett in 1786, and Virginia Dare in 1587. East Germany began construction of the Berlin Wall during mid-August 1961. The United States Congress approved the Social Security Act in mid-August 1935. Finally, the Double Eagle II completed the first balloon crossing of the Atlantic in mid-August 1978. Max Anderson, Ben Abruzzo, and Larry Newman of Albuquerque, New Mexico, landed in France after traveling some 3,200 miles in nearly 6 days. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The Vast Expanse of Geological Time and the Theory of Evolution, this week on Soundings. Carl Stock of the University of Alabama and Nicholas Rupke of the Australian National University discuss geological time, the theory of evolution, and the teaching of science in American schools. Stones and Bones, Time and the Earth's History. Some questions and answers this week on Soundings.